A new poll finds Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump tied in Florida. Corrine Brown returns to federal court, and Nikolai Vidi gets his own report card. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And watch the show now, too, with video on demand at our partner, TVJax.com. Just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, a look ahead to this Sunday's peace concert in Jacksonville on the 15th anniversary of September 11th. Also, the story of musical genius Robert Shaw in a new film. We'll tell you where you can catch that. That's all coming up. But first this hour, it's Friday, and the roundtable is here with that Friday feeling as we welcome Mark Woods of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Lindsay Kilbride, our own WJCT reporter.
Good morning.
And WJCT analyst John Burr.
Good to be here.
So good to see you all, and much to discuss, from Corrine Brown in federal court this week to Nikolai Vidi getting a report card amid tensions between him and the Duval County School Board, and more news. But our top story, Donald Trump campaigns in Florida today as a new poll shows the presidential race between him and Hillary Clinton is a dead heat here in the Sunshine State. Meanwhile, a Democratic group affiliated with an anti-Trump super PAC filed a complaint this week with the Department of Justice. It's against Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, and it's about the $25,000 her reelection campaign accepted in 2013 from the Trump Foundation. Bondi is being criticized in this so-called pay-for-play scandal because she declined to investigate allegations around Trump University after receiving the donation from the GOP presidential nominee. We begin the hour with a closer look at the Trump and Clinton campaigns in Florida and the pay-for-play scandal around the state's attorney general as we take your calls. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, or weigh in on Facebook. Mark Woods, let's begin with you. This flap over the donation Trump gave to Bondi is getting more attention this week. And at the same time, lots of discussion about the commander-in-chief forum between the candidates that aired on NBC this week. Trump and Clinton both chasing Florida's electoral votes. The latest poll has them tied here in Florida. This swing state is the toughest battleground, at least right now.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting that this is kind of bubbled back up because it was big news in Florida back in the spring. A lot of the Florida papers did quite a bit on it, and Orlando Sentinel covered it extensively. I wrote a column about it, and it kind of faded into the background. But then in the last week or so, it's bubbled into the national news big time with New York Times, Washington Post, others writing editorials about it. So I find that kind of intriguing.
That's becoming news again?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And John, it may have something to do with the fact that the Department of Justice is now obligated to respond to this complaint. And how that will play out, we don't know yet. But they're alleging bribery on the part of the Trump campaign.
Well, yeah, it's political season in Florida. And, you know, the New York Times has been I have never seen a newspaper just so openly against a presidential candidate in my life. I mean, they have been smashing Trump on the op-ed page for 6 months now. It's really amazing if you read it. So, you know, yeah, it's back in play, and the questions are serious enough that it deserves some investigation. Whether anything's going to, you know, really be found out in time to affect the election, we'll have to see.
Now, Pam Bondi, the state's attorney general, Lindsay, has denied any wrongdoing, saying that she called Donald Trump several weeks before her office said it was considering joining a lawsuit up in New York against Trump University, and that there's no connection between the two things.
Yeah, she said, of course I called him to ask for money. You know, that's sort of what you do. But I think the real question is this actually going to impact Trump supporters in the election? And I don't know that it will. I think Trump supporters already love Donald Trump, and they already are all, not all, but a lot of them are already against the media. And if there's something that comes out, it's just going to be another, this is something trying to take Trump down. This isn't one of those, you know, the liberal media trying to destroy Trump. So I don't know that it'll drastically impact the election. I think like the main thing is these people like the Mitt Romney types who have said, you know, I'm a Republican, but I'm not a Trump Republican. What is he going to do to win those people? And I think other statements he said have turned them off, like whether it's the Gold Star family or, you know, he just recently tweeted something about, you know, in the military, the reason there's so much sexual assault is because, you know, of course they put men and women together. Well, you know, maybe they should teach consent. But the, you know, so things like that, I think, are the bigger things that are impacting potential voters.
And we'll go to your calls on the top stories of the week as our media roundtable discusses the week's biggest headlines at 549-2937. Right now, give us a call with your thoughts about the presidential race. Meanwhile, Mark Woods, a new Quinnipiac University poll out Thursday, shows that when it comes to the swing states in this presidential contest, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are neck and neck, particularly here in Florida, where the race is now deadlocked. In Ohio, Trump leads Clinton by 1 point, but Hillary Clinton still has an edge in all of the other swing states, giving her an electoral college advantage. For the next 6 to 8 weeks, we're going to be seeing a lot of these candidates here in Florida.
Right. I'm starting to wish we had, like in England, where their elections are compressed.
It's about 4 weeks total.
Right, yeah. Can we please do that?
I know. This has been going on for literally almost 2 years.
Yeah, and I think it was, at one point it was maybe the circus was kind of amusing and entertaining, but, you know, I didn't even watch the Commander-in-Chief
Let's forum. Talk about that. The Commander-in-Chief Forum, moderated by the Today Show's Matt Lauer, and he took a beating of criticism in the way that he handled the questions to the two candidates. John Burr, veterans that were in the audience also expressed disappointment that they didn't get to ask more questions because it was about national security. That was the point of the program.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of criticism of Lauer basically spending a lot of time with Hillary Clinton on emails when that really wasn't the focus of the forum. Also, you know, there was a general feeling that Trump kind of got a bunch of softball questions while Clinton was more or less grilled. You know, the thing is, this was a prep for the debate coming up in, a couple of weeks, I think, the first debate. And you know, I think they were kind of floating positions to see what worked. What didn't work was Trump's telling the generals that the generals had been reduced to a pile of rubble under the Obama administration. I mean, that just didn't go over well. These guys have been fighting war now for 15 years. I'm sure they didn't appreciate that.
And you know what else? Both candidates this week released a long list of all the retired admirals and generals that support their campaigns. There was this contest between them to see which military brass they could draw to their side. That's been another interesting trend to watch. Mark.
Right. That's. I guess that's to be expected. You line up. You know. You get so you can stand on a stage and have those folks standing up there with you. And I think, you know, it seems like Trump seems to have as many flags as he can have lined up behind him. The more flags, the better. It's almost. I feel like there's going to be the old Stephen Colbert skit where a giant eagle's going to come swooping in, and you know, everybody tries to kind of wrap them.
Screaming eagle.
Screaming eagle. Yes. You know, the bigger the flag pin, the better kind of vibe. Yes, it's kind of gotten to that stage now. Yeah.
All right. Lots of calls meanwhile as we talk about the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable, beginning with the new polls showing Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton at a dead tie in Florida. What are your thoughts about the presidential race? 549-2937. Holly in St. Augustine. Hey, Holly, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I've been listening to the program, and thank you so much. I just want to know, I want to ask Trump supporters, what is it going to take? What is it going to take for this man to do, for you to see what type of person he is? Every single day, he offends somebody. Every day, he's doing something. And I don't understand where all of this ignorance comes from. They hate the media, and yet they listen to it over and over, and they fall for all of the lies. What is it going to take, people?
Well,
that's my question.
All right, Holly, thanks for the call. John?
Well, a lot of what helps Trump is a visceral hatred of Hillary Clinton by so many people. And it's been, you know, they've hated Clinton for 25 years, ever since she tried to do health care reform in the 90s. And, you know, it's not so much that people are just totally turned on to Trump, although there certainly are those. But this the level of hatred for Clinton is really astounding.
Well, and let's talk about that for a minute. Both of these candidates have the highest negatives in the history of modern polling. That said, Donald Trump's negatives are higher than Hillary Clinton's negatives. Lindsay.
Yeah, I mean, these are two of the most polarizing candidates. I mean, obviously, you just said data that backed that up, but they are super polarizing candidates. And there are people who will not vote for Hillary Clinton no matter what. They've been saying this since, 2008. And, you know, on the other hand, there are the Trump split the Republican Party. There are people in the Republican Party who will not vote for Trump. So you're right. I mean, these are very polarizing people.
Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to go back to the Bondi and Trump thing. What about Bondi? Is she being pursued about something illegal? Did she give all the documentation to the Trump Foundation so that they were made aware? It just seems like the $2,500 fine is really low. We have a similar situation in Jacksonville with the $2 million going to that PAC to get the sales tax increase to our children. So I wonder if all those people, I think the Jaguars gave over $100,000 and it's all non-taxable. I just wonder, is this the straw that broke the camel's back, or will more things be pursued?
All right. Thank you for that. Pam Bondi is not answering any more questions about this. But here's what we can report. In 2013, the Trump Foundation gave $25,000 to Bondi's PAC. Weeks before that, New York's attorney general filed a lawsuit alleging that Trump University and its affiliates had ripped off 5,000 customers. The Florida AG's office had also received complaints about Trump University, but had not but declined to investigate. It's the appearance of impropriety that is, I think, now ensnaring Pam Bondi in this flap.
Right. I'm not sure there's anything illegal, but it's the questions about it, and I do find it more damning about than a politician giving money. I find it more damning on her end. The questions, and it's not the first. There was a few years ago, New York Times did a huge story about not just her, about attorney generals and across the nation receiving all these trips and gifts from lobbyists and but she was very much in the forefront of that. And it was I think the headline had something to do with pay to look away. It was basically, a company would have some kind of issue that it was potentially being investigated for, and all of a sudden they'd lavish these trips, and not on the specific candidates, but on the Association of Attorney Generals. But they'd go to these events at resorts, and so she has kind of this. You would hope your attorney general would be the epitome of ethics and above the fray, and there's this long thread of this going on. So this is kind of the latest in the Pam Bondi saga.
Now, the caller referenced the fine. Trump paid a $2,500 fine over this donation because his nonprofit, it came via his nonprofit, which isn't supposed to make these types of political donations. That's what she was referring to, was this fine. And was that enough of a was that just a slap on the wrist, I think, is what she was saying.
Well, perhaps. A $2,500 to Donald Trump or his foundation is chump change. What's interesting about this is when you look back at Trump's statements before he was a national candidate about his donations to political to politicians. He was pretty crass about it. He said, hey, you know, you give them money and they'll do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And seen in that light, you know, this kind of looks not so great, especially for Pam Bondi.
Let's go to Max on the South Side. Hey, Max, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
All right, so I'm a white Caucasian, young professional in the sense I actually attend college here at Jacksonville. And I wanted to kind of piggyback off of a previous caller asking, you know, what does it take to get these voters to figure out what's going on with Donald Trump? And overwhelmingly, what I have seen on, you know, news-based shows and media is that a majority of the support behind Donald Trump's campaign are white, undereducated individuals. And I was wondering if your panel could speak to that and see, you know, obviously there's some kind of correlation, but what does it take for these uneducated individuals to get the message across?
Max, thanks for the call. And we've heard that time and time again throughout this campaign that the strongest and most vocal Donald Trump supporters are white folks without a college degree. I'm not sure I necessarily buy that.
Right.
Mark, I think a lot of Republicans who do have college degrees, particularly men, are going to vote for Donald Trump. Maybe not as many white college-educated women, but what do you think?
Right. I think there's a certain element of truth to that, but I think it is a little simplistic. I mean, you have our mayor, you know, leading the rally for Donald Trump. So you can't just say it's the rural, whatever the stereotypical Bubba in his pickup truck kind of thing. And that's kind of part of the X factor in this election. You now have Susie Wiles leading the Florida campaign. So you have folks, as Lindsay talked about, you have the Mitt Romneys, the Bush family has obviously stayed out of it. But there are also some of the movers and shakers in the party are getting involved and are trying to convince their folks to vote for Donald Trump. I don't know how that plays out. That maybe is part of the big X factor in the election.
Lindsay.
Yeah, and I think that I totally just lost what I was about. I was like, I want to jump in.
God, I hate
when that happens. Let's go, as you consider that, we'll go to Steve in Jacksonville Beach. Hey, Steve. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I want to go back to the candidate forum and what I thought was the abysmal performance of Matt Lauer. And I'm just so curious about that, how his approach changed from one candidate to the next. Most people hit him on letting Donald Trump go on his Iraq positions. But when Donald was talking about Russian planes buzzing our forces and Iranian boats harassing our ships, he didn't even have the presence of mind to say, what would you do about that? And I just found that curious and really disappointing.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah.
Well, Matt Lauer was a bad choice for that assignment. I mean, what he does very well, which is interview celebrities and you know, chefs and whatever he does on the Today Show, he does very well. He's fabulous at it. This is not his forte, and it was quite obvious that he was way over his head.
And with the criticism he's taken, the debate moderators were going to be seeing first up Lester Holt, Wallace from Fox News, Martha Raddatz, ABC, and there's going to be a slew of them. They are really now under the microscope it's almost an impossible tightrope to walk.
It is an impossible job. Whoever does it has pretty much been criticized, and they're going to be attacked like, well, you were too soft, you were too hard. I think it's the last job in the world I would want. It sounds like it. You know, Megyn Kelly tried to ask tough questions of Donald Trump and became the focus of news for several weeks, you know. And I think people have, even when they do a good job, you're going to get a lot of criticism. So I guess you have to go into it knowing that.
Brian on the East Side. Hi, Brian. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I was just curious what it would take to actually get Gary Johnson in the debate, to actually ask nonpartisan questions, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the debate committee has set this threshold that the candidates must be polling at least 15% to be on that debate stage, Brian. He's not polling that high, I don't believe. But, you know, the backstory to that as well is that everybody on those debate committees, almost everybody, is a partisan one side or the other, which is why I think it's so difficult for a third-party candidate to be included. John.
Well, and that, plus, you know, the media has pretty much ignored Johnson, you know, and, you know, the other two candidates have gotten 99.9% of the coverage. So basically people have no idea what he stands for or who he is.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are millions of Americans that would like to see the other candidates on the stage. But is it realistically going to happen? Probably not. Well, let's talk about a few other news and notes from the week. The number to join us, 549-2937. It's our Friday roundtable. And Corrine Brown was in federal court Wednesday with a new lawyer. The ousted North Florida congresswoman and her chief of staff are accused of using an unregistered charity to raise $800,000 that prosecutors said they used as a personal slush fund. Among the 22 federal charges against Brown are counts of conspiracy, mail and wire fraud, and violation of tax laws. And Mark Woods, Brown is now being represented by an Orlando lawyer after going through a few legal teams here in Jacksonville, and she's continuing to fight these charges.
Yeah, it's been interesting how hard it is for how hard it has been for her to get, you know, legal representation. And I wonder now that she has lost the election, you know, that obviously should not affect your legal battles, but you no longer have that clout of being a sitting congresswoman.
Yeah.
Which obviously there's going to be when you're in trouble when you're a city when you're in Congress, there's going to be people who want to rally around you because you have that power. When she loses that power, how does that affect the legal battle? I don't know. I think it, mm-hmm. but it's an interesting question. And what plays out the whole saga of trying to find lawyers has been interesting too.
And it looks as though her trial date's going to be pushed back to sometime in early 2017.
Yeah, and now that she's off the ballot for November, in terms of you know, us possibly electing someone who's going to be convicted, that possibility is off the table. So I think the pressure is off in that sense to get the trial going. You know, with Corinne, at this point, it's a run, but you can't hide scenario. It's just a question of when her day in court's going to come. And, mm-hmm. and you know, it seems that she's doing everything she can to avoid that.
So which job would you rather have, debate moderator or
Corrine Brown's attorney?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice,
well,
Mark.
Given my career, I'd say debate moderator.
Tracy in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I am a Republican, but I have a question. What is Donald Trump's educational and political background experience? And besides being a son of a rich real estate empire, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Well, you know, people that like Donald Trump like the fact that he is a political outsider. That's been a big facet of his whole campaign. People that don't like Donald Trump think he's unqualified to hold the office of president.
Right. Well, he went to, you know, prep school, kind of the classic. You know, he likes to criticize elites, but he had this elite growing up of, you know, his dad was one of the wealthiest men in America. And I've written that before, and people said, well, that can't be true. You know, I would have known. And I've said, well, he wasn't Rockefeller rich or, you know, Bill Gates rich. But when Forbes magazine had the first list of wealthiest people in America, Fred Trump was on it. So He started with a pretty good. I think if you or I were grew up in that kind of, we could be successful business people. So that the idea that he's this amazing business person, I think, it should be dissected more than it has been. His educational background is kind of that. You know, it's in some ways it's like the Bushes and the others we've had that are viewed as the elite.
Well, we know that he went to a military school for high school, and he thought that should be considered as military service.
Ed in Orange Park. Go ahead, Ed. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think one of the bigger things that American people are picking up here is that we have two candidates. One who seems to have a problem with what he's saying with his mouth. The other one has a problem with what they've done. And that's a big difference. Somebody, what they say versus what somebody, what they actually have done, especially as a public service, servant to the people, as an employee, which is what Hillary has been doing, Secretary of State, Senator, and so on. And it's just, there's something that just quite doesn't make sense. I think this is why the unpopularity of Hillary hits a spot with a lot of people, is that her main excuse for what she's done with the emails and the servers and all that, she gave four reasons. One, she wanted to keep private her recipes, her yoga instructions, her mother's funeral details, and her daughter's wedding. And anybody who is listening to that kind of excuse, reasoning for all this complicated maneuvering that she's done and lying about how many devices and servers and all that, simply says that's a little bit extreme to keep recipes and wedding details separated. And I think people pick that up, and they think there's something else going on.
Thanks, Ed. All right. And in a moment, we're going to move on to other news. But go ahead, John.
Well, in fairness to Clinton, she says that one of the main reasons she set it up is on advice of Colin Powell, who was the former Secretary of State. And that's been backed up by an email that Powell sent to Clinton 3 days after she took office. So, you know, I'm not sure about all those personal reasons the caller listed, but, you know, that seems to be a pretty solid.
Well, and we're going to keep talking about the news of the week, but we do have to – I know people still want to talk about the presidential race, but we need to make note of a couple other items, including what happened at the Duval County School Board this week. Duval County School Board members gave Superintendent Nicolai Vitti his own report card, rating him as effective. But Lindsay Kilbride, as you've been reporting, there is still tension between Vitti and the board over academic performance in the district.
Yeah, I've been going to these meetings for a while, and his last evaluation was actually in March, which, you know, wasn't very long ago. The school grades came in really late, so that evaluation was for the 2014-15 school year. This one recently was the 2015-16. But you can't really have an evaluation in March and not take into account things that just recently happened. So the evaluation isn't drastically different this time compared to last time. He got a score of effective last time overall. He got a score of effective this time overall, although the board does seem a little bit more polarized. So, for instance, last time all of his scores, and this is just basically how it works, is they have rate him one through four on all these different measures, 15 different areas. And then those scores, you get a number, you add them up, you get a number, and it'll put you in a category: effective, highly effective, needs improvement, or unsatisfactory. So like last time, he was only scored as effective and highly effective, a combination of the two. This time, though, some people scored him as highly effective, some people scored him as effective, and some people scored him as needs improvement, which that didn't happen last time. Mm-hmm. The biggest issues that the school board seems to be having, and I don't think it's a secret to the public, is that, you know, there's an issue with communication, with the way things are decided upon, with him taking what they believe should happen into consideration. I think it's very much they relayed that they want him to brief them before going to the public, going to the media. Sometimes they're finding things out through the paper, through us, before it hits them. Mm-hmm. And they're not too happy with that. Not all of them, but the ones who did raise concerns about that was some of their bigger issues.
You know, for those that have lived in this area a long time, this is the latest in a long line of superintendents that are brought in to try to improve student performance but they run headlong into this buzzsaw of school board politics. And this is not unique to Jacksonville by any means.
Right. But it does feel like we've seen this movie before, and it's disappointing that it plays out. And, you know, I'd like to think we can do things differently this way and, have a superintendent stay. Change isn't going to happen overnight. Scores aren't going to just skyrocket in 2 years. It's been a tumultuous time for education, particularly in the state of Florida, with the way grades have been done. They've been kind of almost a farce the last few years. And so I think, superintendent and school boards and anybody and teachers and administrators and everybody, they've had a lot to deal with in the last decade. And I sometimes look at it as a parent. I feel, a parent of a child in Duval County Schools, I feel optimistic and positive about where our schools are. And I sometimes, when there's criticism of them, find myself going into defending, Duval County Schools mode. So there certainly are issues, but I feel good and optimistic about where our schools are headed.
You know, we have seen this movie before in terms of the back and forth between the superintendent and the school board. The part of the movie we haven't seen, frankly, before this is the improvement in the schools. Mm-hmm. And, I think VD deserves credit for turning around this aircraft carrier at very, slowly. But, he's done a lot more in that regard than his predecessors, a lot more.
All right. And then finally, having flopped with the New York Jets, Tim Tebow is trying to revive his career as an outfielder with the Mets. The 29-year-old Tebow agreed Thursday to a minor league contract with the Mets with a $100,000 signing bonus. Tebow reporting next weekend to the Instructional League in Port St. Lucie. He's going to test out his baseball skills for a few weeks. I guess you could drive on down there and watch him. Yeah. How about that?
Yeah. Joe DeSalvo in our office, who's a New Yorker, said, he's Jets, Mets, the next will be the Nets, the New York Nets. So I guess he wants to be in the New York tabloids
That's
all the
right.
time.
Well, good luck to him.
Is he a pitcher or a hitter? I'm confused. Everybody talks about what a great hitter he was.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Well, only in Florida does a spurned girlfriend set fire to her ex's car, except she picked the wrong car. They say hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, and 19-year-old Carmen Chambly of Clearwater proved it when she tried to get revenge on her ex-boyfriend by setting fire to his vehicle. There was just one problem. It was the wrong car. Ooh. The former owner of a Honda Civic named Thomas Jennings was flummoxed when he saw the giant blaze. Chambly allegedly stuck a rag in the gas's car tank and set it ablaze. She might have also used a flammable liquid to bring misdirected fury to this forsaken four-door. It reminded us that back in 2014, a Jacksonville resident incinerated a man's car because he refused to buy her a McFlurry. At that point, she became McFlurious. Only in Florida. And we're a little light on time, but only in Florida do people impersonate U.S. Senator Dick Durbin to get out of paying off their home loan. 67-year-old Sidney Hines did this down in Newport Richey. He claimed to be Dick Durbin and said his loan had been paid in full. The feds didn't buy it. I know. Yeah, so random.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark Woods, John Burr, and Lindsay Kilbride. Have a great weekend. We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
From the panhandle to the peninsula, the Sunshine State's politics are as hot as the weather. Trump versus Clinton, the race for the U.S. Senate, new political boundaries and familiar issues. Join 89.9 every Friday at 1 p.m. for Decision Florida, starting September 9th. Let your voice be heard.
WJCT presents Travis Pickney, our 2016 American Graduate Champion of the First Coast, dedicated to mentoring our youth.
The College Red program got started by me looking at students who looked like me, who had the same backgrounds as me, and who were going through the same struggles I was going through in high school.
To hear more stories of champions, watch American Graduate Day on WJCT, Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m.
Do you have music you want people to hear? Do you have an artistic vision you want to share? Then join these winners in the Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT TV and radio. Submit your work now through September 30th. To learn more about the Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/the square.
Welcome back. Well, this Sunday marks the 15th anniversary of the September 11th attacks on America. To mark the occasion, the Jacksonville Sister Cities Association and One Jacks are presenting this year's annual peace concert. Now, this peace-building event coincides with concerts held around the world each year on 9/11. Dr. Tanjala Manley is president of the Jacksonville Sister Cities Association. Good morning, Dr. Manley.
Thank you.
Hard to believe it's been 15 years.
It has been, and we are healing from that tragedy.
Yes, changed the country in innumerable ways, but this is a positive way to express a lot of feelings. And as I said, this is just one of many concerts that will be happening simultaneously worldwide on September 11th. Is that something that a tradition that's grown over the years, I take it?
Yes, it has. It is a program that is supported by the Sister Cities International. So we have concerts, September concerts around the world. Almost 2,000 cities recognize this event with a concert.
This is a free concert, too.
Yes.
And you want to invite the public to come out. This is Sunday, September 11th at 6 o'clock at St. John's Cathedral, downtown on Church Street, which is a beautiful setting.
Yes. We love the church because it has wonderful acoustics. And Dr. Kara Tasha from UNF has directed this program for many years, so she really insists that we do it there.
Right.
And this year we're doing it with overflow capacity because we expect to have a lot more people there.
That's wonderful. What will the music program consist of?
Well, we have three groups. We have the Jacksonville Children's Choir, the Douglas Anderson School of Arts, as well as the UNF Chamber Singers. And if you've never heard the UNF Chamber Singers, if you come, you'll be in for a treat.
Absolutely. So all the local musical talent will be on hand, but it's also a really nice community event for people that want to mark this occasion.
Yes, yes. And we, as the Sister Cities Association, we want to encourage people to become more educated about the world around us. So we have our eight sister cities. We're going to have a reception after the event, and we're going to have each of our sister cities presenting foods and just some cultural items and talking about our sister cities.
Who are our sister cities? I don't even know who our sister cities are.
Well, we have eight.
Okay.
Bahia Blanca, Argentina, Curitiba, Brazil, Changwon City, South Korea, Murmansk, Russia, Nantes, France, Nelson Mandela Bay, South Africa.
Oh, wow.
San Juan, Puerto Rico, and Yingkou, China. And then we have three friendship cities within China.
Oh, my gosh. How were those chosen?
Well, we select cities that are similar to us in terms of geography. We have mostly, all of them are port cities.
Okay.
And then we have cities that start out with similar populations as well. So
about the same size.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. When we do start the Sister City Agreement. And then, you know, they grow, we grow. But we find that the similarities allow us to have something to talk about and work through.
This is a wonderful cultural exchange. And if you come out Sunday to mark the 15th anniversary of 9/11, you can learn about it. The Jacksonville Sister Cities Association and One Jacks sponsoring this free peace concert on September 11th, 6 o'clock at St. John's Cathedral. That's at 256 East Church Street. But as you said, Doctor, get there early. This
yes.
is going to be very, very well attended, I'm sure.
Yes. And we are expecting to also live stream it through the St. John's Cathedral internet site.
Very nice. Hard to believe it's been 15 years since that terrible day, but this is certainly a positive event to mark it. Dr. Tonjala Manley of the Jacksonville Sister Cities Association, thanks for being here. Again, that concert is Sunday at St. John's Cathedral at 6 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. In their first joint appearance of the election season, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump square off on national security. The Senate fails once again to pass Zika funding. And a wave of shootings in Chicago pushes the city's homicide count to more than 500 so far in 2016.
At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJZT, your community, your world.
WJCT is a community-supported station, and your contribution helps programs like our radio reading service for those who are visually impaired or have difficulty handling printed materials. If you'd like to specifically help radio reading, denote that on your check and send it to us at WJCT, 100 Festival Park Avenue, Jacksonville, Florida, 32202. And thanks for helping us give voice to the printed word.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, Part 2. Sponsored in part by AARP, Real Possibilities.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's the story of a small-town California boy who originally planned to be a minister like his father, but instead he became the greatest conductor of choral music the world has ever known.
One of the things I remember about Robert Shaw was how different a person he was at a private supper with just me and him and my wife and a couple of other folks. And when he went on the stage, it looked like it was just a total transformation for a human being. Because he was totally in charge and totally dynamic and totally evocative and expressed his inner feelings on that stage with his other performers in a way that really brought sometimes cheers and sometimes tears.
And that was former President Jimmy Carter talking about Robert Shaw, the former director of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. The documentary Robert Shaw, Man of Many Voices, screens Monday night at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. And Shaw was renowned as a genius, as we learn in this film, who had no formal musical training. But he became legendary for his interpretations of classical music's greatest choral works. The River City Men's and Women's Courts and Duval County Public Schools are sponsoring this event. Here with a preview, Wayne Bailey of the Chorus and Dale Choate of DCPS. Hey, guys. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for being here. Until you told me about this, Wayne, I'd never heard of Robert Shaw. So this is one of the things I love in doing this work is learning all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Who was Robert Shaw?
Well, he was considered by many the greatest choral musician at 27. Not bad for somebody, as you said, who had no formal music training. He was relentless. He was just he never saw a great performance. he always said that it was. It could be better, you know, it could be better. So there was something about the personality. I thought President Carter hit it right on the head, you know. When he stepped in front of the podium, it was all business. It was just all business.
Now, when Shaw became musical director of the Symphony Orchestra in Atlanta, he had no formal training as a conductor. That's really unprecedented. And not only was he great at it, he integrated the orchestra, and he made a number of changes that were seen as groundbreaking for the time.
They were small before him. They became a professional orchestra of some renown, and they give him total credit for that. When he made the decision to go to Atlanta, a lot of people thought that'd be the end of his career. He should have gone to New York instead. But he felt very strongly about civil rights in Atlanta, and he was going to make a difference. And he did. He did.
Now, Dale, Duval County Public Schools is co-sponsoring this screening at Douglas Anderson. This sounds as though it'll be a learning opportunity for the kids and the adults.
Yes, actually, we are doing two screenings of the film. First of all, Monday night for the community at large, but also we're doing another screening of the film on Tuesday morning for some schools to come in, bring their students, and also to enjoy a performance by the River City Men's and Women's Choruses.
Oh, right. So people can see the film and hear some of your group singing, which is tremendous.
Yes, we'll start the program with the singing. And since Mr. Shaw was such a supporter of amateurism, he felt very strongly about that. He said the true test of an amateur singer is if they were doing it for the love of it rather than for any kind of money. So
right.
And he required far more out of the singers,
uh-huh.
even though they were not getting paid, you know.
Now, I didn't know this, but the chorus and the orchestra that he led, it was the largest performing arts group to tour Europe when it first went across Europe. It sold out concerts all over Europe. And the woman who made this film, Robert Shaw, Man of Many Voices, was so moved by the response that she decided to make a film about him.
And
is that how it all came
together? It's very well done. Well, one of them is a member of the chorus. And he sang with the Robert Shaw Chorale in 30 countries. You know, at a time where it was very difficult, and they would have weeks where they wouldn't be able to make the payroll, and he would take the money out of his pocket and pay the orchestra. You know, so it was just really amazing.
How was he able to become such a renowned conductor without any training? That's really I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, well, he used to say he learned from the singers. You know, like in New York City when he did the, it was called what was it called, Dale? And in New York City, the Collegiate Chorale.
Yeah.
Right, the Collegiate Chorale. He said, yeah, he had like 600 people audition, and he whittled it down, and then he learned. He listened. But he had conducted through probably with the Cleveland Orchestra some stuff. But not everybody was terribly pleased, all the orchestra, when he rolled in, because he was always going to be the choral guy. You know?
But he could do it all, right?
Yes, he could.
Mastered all right. The forms of music.
He did. In fact, I know that he had a contract with RCA many years ago with the Robert Shaw Chorale. And a lot of choral conductors have kind of cut their teeth on some of the arrangements that he and Alice Parker did together. And those arrangements came about through that contract. RCA would say, well, we'll let you record a Bach B minor Mass or a Mozart Requiem, but the next album needs to be folk songs or Christmas carols. And so he and Alice Parker arranged these beautiful carols and hymns and folk songs
Very singable. Yeah. Well, you know, talking about the Atlanta Symphony Chorus and Atlanta Symphony touring Europe in his later years, he would go to Germany and do Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. and they would stand and wouldn't leave. I mean, they would keep
on. He did
on
it better than the Germans. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, the text itself is a, you know, it was not that late after the Second World War, so it was a courageous thing to do. But
yeah.
There was no resentment in that hall that Americans were coming over and singing that German piece because they just sang the shoes off of it.
It was so lovely, so moving.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, you know, that part, the little excerpt, there was something, you know, immediately I sat up straight. You know, he had a virility in his music that was just unmatched. I mean, you can tell a Shaw recording, and there are no strings. I mean, he can't make the group do it, but he can sure rehearse them until they decide it's their idea.
Yeah, I think the Beethoven Ninth was probably where he received the most notoriety when he performed with Toscanini, and again at 27 years old, and Toscanini said, "At last, I've finally found the conductor I'm looking for."
Oh, wow.
And there's a blip of that there however they recorded it, where Toscanini takes all the bows and he walks off the stage dramatically and pulls a young Robert Shaw on who's got his shoulders. He was so
very humble.
Very humble, yeah. And
these types of documentaries can really immerse you in a fascinating world you never knew about. So go on out. This is Monday night at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, a screening of Robert Shaw, Man of Many Voices, sponsored by the River City Men's and Women's Chorus and Duval County Public Schools. Thanks for sharing this, gentlemen.
Thanks you. And it's an honest film. It's warts and all. They tell the whole story.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app and watch video on demand at tvjax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, the Friday News Roundup. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump square off on national security. The Senate fails again to pass Zika funding and a wave of shootings in Chicago. A panel of journalists joins guest host John Donvan for analysis of the week's top national news stories. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again Monday at 9 a.m. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.